Harvest USA is a ministry that started here at 10th in the early 80s as an outreach to the gay community. And in the 25 plus years since then, we've expanded to have offices in Chattanooga that reaches out to the Mid-South and to Pittsburgh. And we still reach out to men and women who are struggling with same-sex issues, but we have expanded, especially over the last 10 years, by reaching out to people who are struggling with pornography, internet addiction, sexual addiction, and we have noticed, especially in the last 10 to 12, 13 years, that those problems are not out there. Those problems are in here, in the church. And so the beginning of Harvest, mostly it was an evangelistic outreach. Now, we're mostly dealing with people who are professing Christians. That's a huge shift. We still do outreach. We still do evangelistic work. But the whole clientele has changed. Last night, Joshua Harris spoke on God's design for sex and how sex, if it is to be beautiful, needs to be within proper boundaries. Let me take a little step back. Does everybody have an outline? The bigger outline. Very good. All right. He spoke about the damage that is done to people who use sex outside of God's boundary lines, how it leads to enslavement and death. That was his exegesis of Proverbs 5. But we also know that sexual sin does not damage only the one who does the sin. No sin is ever private or personal. And such a powerful gift as sex creates chaos when it is used wrongly. And I think no damage is greater, no damage is more horrific, and no damage tends to be as long-lasting as the damage that comes from sexual abuse. Although we don't keep statistics at Harvest USA, we have men and women who come into our offices seeking help for their sexual struggles and sins. But we are not surprised when we find that an overwhelming majority of the women who come into our offices have experienced sexual abuse, and also a very high percentage of men as well. This is a dark topic. Maybe it's kind of appropriate. We're in the basement. We're in the catacombs. You may feel extremely gloomy after a while, but this is a topic that it's very hard for light to shine. Light does, but it is. I come at this topic with a lot of trepidation. I have, and you're like me, I have close friends who have been sexually abused. I have one close friend who I have walked with for over 30 years, and I've seen the impact of sexual abuse in his life. I have been on a pastoral staff, and I also do pastoral counseling at Harvest, and I have worked with men and women who struggle with the impact of abuse in their lives. This is an uncomfortable topic. And I want to say that I've been trained and have experience as a pastor. I do pastoral counseling. I'm a ruling elder in a PCA church, so I'm kosher here. But I'm not a clinical therapist. And I say that because of this. One, I have a firm belief that the gospel of Christ is essential for someone to redemptively through the impact of sexual abuse. And I believe the church and God's people are essential in that process. But I also believe that for many people who have experienced sexual abuse, that professional counseling is vital as well, especially if the abuse occurred when the survivor was very young, or if it went on for many years, or if the abuse was violent or sadistic. Those particular traumas can go very, very deep into a person's soul and life. And it can be very helpful and sometimes necessary for someone to meet with someone who is clinically trained and is regularly available, because it will not be an easy process to work through this particular issue. Much of my talk today, I'm indebted to someone that I consider to be a giant in the field, and that is Dr. Diane Langberg, who's a psychologist in Jenkintown. And if you're interested in resource materials on sexual abuse, I think her books are simply, they're the best. They are the most accessible. And the one that I've worked off heavily here is called On the Threshold of Hope, Opening the Door to Healing for Survivors of Sexual Abuse. I think it might be, but I don't know. If it's not, okay. I think we had given them the topic in the book, but maybe it just didn't come through. Now, the reason why I say that I'm not a clinical therapist, because I want to lay out before you what this workshop is not intending on doing and what it is intending on doing. And that's important. One, I am not going to give you here professional level training on how to heal someone or be part of the healing of someone who's gone through sexual abuse. That's not me. There's other people who could do that. And two, in the time that we have, I just can't cover this topic exhaustively. This is a huge topic. And for someone to be a student of this topic, you'll be studying this for years. I'm going to give you a slice of it, but I hope an important slice that will enable you to feel like God can call you to step into the lives of people that you know are sexually broken. So what I want to accomplish this morning is this. Two things. I want you to grasp something of the substantial damage that sexual abuse does to a person. That's the first thing I want to do. We're going to have to talk about the bad stuff. And there's two reasons for doing this. One, you got to know what the problem is before you know how to correct it. Okay? By way of illustration, I have a severely disabled son at home who is nonverbal, paralyzed, doesn't move, totally dependent 24/7 on care. And a couple of years ago, he had a lot of GI problems. And it got so bad that we couldn't get him out of the house. He couldn't go to school. We couldn't go to church. We were trapped inside the home for like 8 months. Now, in my, of course, fatherly wisdom, I kept pressuring the doctors. Isn't there a pill for this? Isn't there something that can stop what's going on? He had almost unstoppable diarrhea. It was really hard on him and on us. And the doctors kept saying at Children's Hospital, unless we know exactly what's going on, giving him something for the symptoms could hurt him even more. I didn't believe him. But after 8 months, what we discovered was that he had three more diseases that were bunched into a cluster. And if he had simply gotten medicine to treat the obvious symptom, it would not have helped him. It may have hurt him. Finally, we were able to apply the right medicine for what he was going through. It's the same thing with this particular topic. If you're going to reach out and walk alongside somebody who is struggling with the impact of sexual abuse, you're going to have to know, you're going to have to enter their world. You're going to have to know, you're going to have to feel what the bad stuff is like. And secondly, the reason why we have to talk about the bad stuff, and I don't see this as much as I used to, but there are still some in the church who mistakenly think that past injuries, past history, past trauma, can just be put aside. And what you need to do is look ahead and just focus on Christ. Well, yes. Focus on Christ. Look ahead to his grace, present grace and his future grace. But even God first shows us our need for him by exposing us to the bad stuff inside of us and what we do, in order that we might be able to fully grasp the cure, which is his grace. And I should say that Jesus doesn't do that one time in our lives, does he? He digs it up all the time, but it's grace work. So we're going to start talking about the bad stuff first, and then I want to talk about something about how do you walk alongside of someone who is struggling with sexual abuse. And I'm going to start out talking about how you as an individual, a friend, can come alongside and help that person. And then I hope to have time, which I really didn't in the first time, to talk about how the church corporately, as a structure of the church, can can help as well. So I hope I can get there. All right, on your outline, we're at definition. We really ought to, I think most people nowadays, particularly with the advent of the computer and TV, talk shows, education, we're much more informed about what sexual abuse is. But let me give you a quick working definition. Sexual abuse is any sexual activity, non-consensual, that exploits a person by anyone who is older or more powerful than the victim. Sexual abuse is any sexual activity, non-consensual, that exploits a person by anyone who is older or more powerful than the victim. It can be verbal, it can be visual, it can be physical. Most people think that sexual abuse is primarily involves the physical aspect of sex, and it isn't. Someone who talks provocatively and suggestively to a young child is sexually abusing them. Someone who shows a child pornography for the sake of exploiting that child is committing sexual abuse. And here's one of the major qualifications here about sexual abuse. Sexual abuse is done by the abuser for the satisfaction of the abuser because they need to meet some sort of twisted or disordered need within themselves. Okay? It is the abuser feeding off the survivor in a way that is so soul damaging. One more qualification, maybe two more. One, all sexual abuse is damaging, but some sexual abuse is more damaging than others. Sexual abuse at a young age, abuse that occurs over an extended period of time, abuse that is done to a child by someone they are very close to, like a father or mother or an uncle, and abuse that is done by someone who's much older, and abuse that is violent or sadistic, is the most damaging type of all. They need to know that. How common is sexual abuse? Well, statistics show that at least 1 in 4 women have experienced some level of sexual abuse in their lives, and 1 in 6 men. And from my work at Harvest USA, I'm beginning to believe that that 1 in 6 figure might actually be too low at this point. Men in particular are much more shamed and secretive about being abused, particularly as a child. Women are as well, but men even more so. And one horrifying statistic is, and it chilled me when I was a father and my daughter turned 8 years old, but the most common age for sexual abuse to occur is between the ages of 8 and 12. Think about that. It's chilling. Let's go to the outline part C. Okay, I'm sorry, we've got to talk about the bad stuff first before we get to the good stuff. What are some of the major areas of damage to a person who has been sexually abused? Sexual abuse damages a person's body, their mind, and their heart. And even though every abuse survivor responds uniquely to the abuse that they endure and suffer, there are common themes that are present in virtually everyone. And within those common themes or areas, there are multiple impacts. This morning I'm going to talk about 5 common areas that are impacted by sexual abuse. But I can only touch upon maybe 1 or 2 of the impacts within those areas, because again, I don't have all the time. But here's how I want to come at it. I hope that I'm not going to come at this just like, oh, here's a list of things you need to know when you work with someone and walk along with someone who suffered sexual abuse. The person you are walking alongside of is flesh and blood, is real life. And you are going to need to know and feel as much as you can know and feel what their life and their world is like. If you're going to be able to enter into their life in an incarnational and redemptive way. So what I want you to do is feel the impact of what I'm saying as much as possible, because that's what you will need to do with the people that you are walking alongside of. Let's talk about the first area of damage, emotions. Sexual abuse damages your sense of security and safety. You know, we like to say as Christians that the world's broken and we can't rely on anything or anyone but God. And that's true. That's really true. But at the same time, the world you and I live in is really stable. And it's pretty regular in many ways. Morning comes after evening. Spring is going to come soon. The lights go on when I flick the switch. The car starts when I turn the key. All those things that I am used to that I do daily, seasonally, build in a sense of security into my life, sense of regularity. Think about the people in Chile. They've been traumatized by the earthquakes and the aftershocks. In the hours and days that have followed, the thing that they used to take for granted, that you and I still do, because we don't live in an earthquake zone, is they have lost their sense of safety and security. It's collapsed. Now, I say this because this is what happens to people when sudden or ongoing trauma occurs in their life. It's almost impossible to live with constant terror. Could you go back inside, if you were living in Chile, could you go back inside your home and live there if you felt that your house could collapse on your head any minute? You couldn't do it. But what if you were forced to live with a constant level of fear and terror inside your own home? That is going to shape you and alter you in ways that are profound. Think about a child sexual abuse survivor living in a home where her father continually abuses her. He violates her repeatedly over the years, and her mother cannot or does not protect her. Her appeals to her father are ignored or they're swept away. You know, for most of us, the home is the place we go to escape the stress and the problems out there. But for a survivor, it becomes a place of continual horror and terror. They do not know what safety and security means. It has collapsed. When your sense of security and safety is lost through these traumatic events, one of the things that's going to shape and alter you is that feeling of helplessness and powerlessness. Those are two very important words, helplessness and powerlessness. There's no one to protect you. You're unable to help yourself, and you feel utterly alone. And you feel incapable of changing your environment or your circumstances to prevent a reoccurrence of the abuse. Diane Langberg, in her book, uses a very vivid metaphor to describe this. She says, abuse takes away the person's voice. It takes away their voice. Imagine being unable to tell someone your hurts, your fears, your wounds, your terrors. Imagine being totally unable to tell someone. Imagine pleading with someone to stop hurting you, and then they viciously ignore your pleas. Imagine living in a home where you can't say anything because you know no one is going to protect you at all anyway. Most of us don't occupy that type of world, but it's the world that most survivors do occupy. I've gotten a little taste of that in my own life to help me sense that with my son. Again, he's disabled, he's nonverbal, he doesn't move a muscle, his body is very fragile and broken. And early on in his life, as careful as we were, we would move him and we would break his leg. And sometimes those breaks were small, and we didn't know. And he'd be agitated a little, and he'd cry, and okay, we try to give him the 64 questions. Is it this? Is it this? Is it this? And he can answer it by looking up for yes or down for no. And only when the leg began to swell and become red, he realized he broke his leg. And we did that numerous times. I began to sense what it was like for someone, my son, to lie there and not know how to say, don't do that! Real powerless, real helpless. an abuse survivor will lose his or her voice to say, don't do that, stop that, help me. Because they realize that nothing is really going to work for them. And so what happens with this? One, fear becomes burned in to the abuse survivor. The sense of fear is, one, about how do you protect yourself. And if nothing you can do to protect yourself, then that fear is just going to be embedded into your mind and your heart. And a lot of behaviors can flow out of that. Fear, we use a lot of coping mechanisms in our life about when it comes to fear. And abuse survivors will do several things. They will isolate themselves. They will keep a safe distance from people. They will slip into a constant state of depression. Many will use anger to protect themselves, sensing danger all the time, a sort of hyper-arousal. There'll be a level of irritability and anger and rage within them. And a lot of them will numb themselves in any way they can. Addiction with food, with alcohol, with drugs, with sex. It's the way that they can cope with feeling helpless and powerless. The second area where abuse damages is relationships. And it damages the abuse survivor's ability to know what trust is. We do not live in this world apart from relationships. It's how we were designed and created. God himself lives in relationship. It's the mystery of the Trinity. And the glue that holds relationships together is trust. And just like if you could not live in your house peacefully, if you thought it was going to collapse on your head any minute, you will not also have deep, loving, satisfying relationships when trust is absent. So think about how we develop trust. We develop trust as a child, right? Children are the most dependent of all beings. They look to adults to give them what they need to function in a world that's not designed for them, but for adults. And so in that primary relationship with their family, they learn how to trust their mom and their dad. And then if they're a good mom and dad, they're going to teach them how to transfer that trust to other adults, teachers, pastors, Sunday school leaders, policemen, firemen, etc. That's how we learn to function socially. What sexual abuse does is damage that core element that must be necessary for healthy relationships, trust. Instead of learning to expect nurturing and protection, the abuse survivor learns to expect hurt. And so, over time, the abuse survivor becomes extremely confused about relationships and how they work. And there's a further complication to this whole idea of trust that comes into play as well. Okay? It's linked to another aspect of who we are as people created in God's image. We long for relationships. My favorite theologian comes from Freehold, New Jersey, Bruce Springsteen. Great. If you listen to his music, he's a great theologian, particularly of life. His line, his word, "Everybody has a hungry heart," says so much about who we are. We have hungry hearts. We long for relationships with people. And those hungry hearts, though, are broken. They're broken because of sin. And in those hungry hearts that we have, I will say that the thing that most people I have come across, and I'd say it's probably for you too, I bet the thing that you most dread in your life is being utterly alone. Loneliness, people will avoid just about anything. And when you think about abuse, think about this. Loneliness is one of the major puppet strings that abusers use to manipulate and control the person they are abusing. So you have this interplay of confused trust and longing. And it raises this puzzle that a lot of us have. Why do abuse survivors keep going back to the abuser? Why do abuse survivors keep going to people who keep abusing them? And I didn't, it's confusing. But I think it's because of this interplay between trust and deep longing that can't be extinguished in a lie. I have a close friend who taught me what this was like. He was 18 years old, and he went to college. And he grew up without a dad. And he always longed for the attention of a father figure. And in his freshman year in college, there was a professor who gave him incredible time and attention. It was the first time he had ever had a man give him that time and attention. Only years later did he realize that that was what's called grooming. You groom the victim. And so the professor would invite him over to his house, where he eventually, over time, abused him. And my friend knew that this was wrong. I mean, he was a Christian. The professor was a Christian. He was a Christian college. And after the abuse, the professor would pray with him. You realize how confused he got? And so he and my friend knew what it was wrong. And it tore him up, but he kept being enticed by the professor in the relationship. And for the whole semester, he kept going back and being abused. And the only way he was successful in getting away from the abuse was when the semester ended, he quit college. And he didn't return. That gave me a picture of what it's like in a relationship like that. And so in the shattering of trust is all about betrayal. You give your heart to someone, and that person seeks to destroy it for their purpose, for their uses. Trust is a learned skill that is fragile and easily broken. Third, in the area of thinking, sexual abuse damages the way you think about yourself and about others. Sexual abuse and its impact on the survivor will move them to begin to believe lies about themselves and about significant others in their lives. One, they will begin to believe lies about important people in their life. That's especially true for child abuse survivors. It's not uncommon to find survivors from child abuse who feel a strong need to absolve the caretaker from the abuse that they have done to them. It's partly the conflict between the trust and longing issue, but it's also because the survivor has to believe a lie because at one level it's intolerable for the child to believe that their mother or their father is a danger and a threat. And the confusion sets in, of course. My father's a good father. He provides for the family. He talks about me publicly and he praises me. And yet at night he comes into my room and he rapes me. And he threatens me. What a child tends to do is shove one of those contradictory images of their father into a deep cavern. And what they will shove into that cavern is the reality that their parent is an abuser. We're talking denial here, right? Deep denial. When I was on the pastoral staff at New Life many years ago, this was illustrated with a woman who was coming to me with her soon-to-be husband for pre-marriage counseling. And this woman was an extremely fearful, anxious, rigid, and controlling person. So at some point, it seemed appropriate, and it was, I was going to kick back from just doing standard premarital counseling at this point, and I went after her past. What was it like growing up? What happened? And all I could get from her was, my father is a good man. My father was a good provider. And I could not break through. The breakthrough occurred, unfortunately, 2 days before her wedding. Her soon-to-be husband was also a very fearful man, and he canceled the wedding. And all she wanted, I should point out that she was older, getting married. She was almost 40 at that point. She longed to be in a marriage. And the wedding collapsed, and she fell into a suicidal pattern over the next year, followed by multiple hospitalizations. It was only there that she began the wall, the incredible concrete wall of her denial about her father began to be broken. And it was only then that she began to confront the fact that her father was an evil man. Diane Langberg calls this double think. It's holding two contradictory images of significant people in your mind at the same time. It not only causes great confusion, but it results in great denial about reality in a person's life. The second thing abuse does, it leaves you with lies you believe about yourself. And some of these I'll just mention here are very common. I'm worthless because I've been treated this way. I'm responsible because of the way I dressed, or because of my gender, or because I wasn't able to stop it. I must work very hard. I must be perfect in my relationships so that I won't get abused again. These lies are so burned into the heart of an abuse survivor that you will not counteract them with logical reasoning. Okay? They go very, very deep. They're deeply entrenched. 4, sexual abuse damages the way you think and feel about your body. You know, Christians, I think we already feel pretty ambivalent about our bodies to begin with. You know, it's through our bodies we live, it's through our bodies that we experience pleasure and happiness. It's through our bodies that as we grow up, we feel confusion, we feel embarrassment as we mature. It's through our bodies that we sin and are sinned against. And there's a tendency in a lot of Christians to sort of favor the spirit over the body. You know, the flesh is willing. No, opposite. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And we tend to demean the body. We tend to think of it in more negative terms. But that's not what Christianity teaches. God's word blesses the body. It's his temple. It will one day be resurrected and be what it was meant to be. God inhabited a human body, and so he honors the body. But that inherent ambivalence about our body, sexual abuse, utterly trashes it. So if you're working with an abuse survivor, you need to know how they think about their body, how they feel about it. Think about this. To be in a relationship with somebody who only wants you for your body is to begin to loathe and hate your own body. Your body is the only thing they want, and if you hate what they're doing to your body, then you can't escape your body. Your body is bad. What should be yours to protect, nurture, and care for becomes your very enemy. Think about this. To live in a body that recoiled at the abuse while it was happening, and possibly at the same time feeling pleasure from the abuse, because that's how a body is made, is to begin to experience or to know about the shame and self-hatred of your body. You feel like your body betrayed you. And you feel dishonored, you feel humiliated, and you feel degraded. And when you feel like trash, when you feel like your body is trash, then you're going to believe that you are trash. And you're going to believe that your body is trash. I've been reading a lot lately about women who had a life once of prostitution and being porn stars. And I've been reading about how they came through that journey. And like I said about the people we see at Harvest, I don't know the statistics, but almost everything I read seems to indicate that those who get into a life of prostitution or become become porn actresses, there's an enormous amount of child abuse in their lives. Incredible. And so what they did was they learned, growing up, from that abuse, that their bodies were the sum total of their worth. And so in destructive ways, they just further trashed their bodies. But now, finally, being old enough, they could actually gain some profit from their bodies, money. And in the use of their bodies, even in a demeaning and degrading way, they could actually have some power over men in the use of their bodies. So the effects of sexual abuse on the body are long-term. And lastly, sexual abuse damages your view of God. To live in a fallen world means that every single one of us here, to some extent, has to live daily with what is unanswerable. We all know this question. If God is good, all good, and if God is all powerful, then why is there evil and justice and injustice? This is not just a philosophical riddle that people play with in their minds. What one believes about God will shape the way, let me put it this way, what you believe about God will shape the way you feel and treat you. That's important. What you think about God, what you feel about God, will shape the way you think He treats you. And so if you grow up in the church, hearing and learning that God is love and He's the protector of the weak, and He's a refuge for the oppressed, how do you reconcile the abuse you suffered when it seemed like God either didn't notice or didn't care? The abuse survivor will usually conclude that God has discarded her, just like the men who mistreated her. Or in addition, yeah, sure, God is love. But me? No, me He doesn't love. How could He? He was never there. He never helped. To live with this confusion about God is to live with the absence of hope. That's one of the most major things that breaks apart in an abuse survivor's world. Hope is believing that what we desire can truly happen, possible. But the abuse teaches you otherwise, that you are helpless and powerless to do anything to reach that goal. And then hope slowly becomes extinguished. And one of the things that is very evident is that people who are abuse survivors don't ever want to feel hope. Because hope, when it rises up within them, they begin to believe that it's only going to set them up for failure. They kill hope inside of themselves. And so most abuse survivors emotionally will be very flat. They won't feel anything. It reminds me of that passage in Ephesians which says about those who were non-Christians before they became Christians, that the state of their life was without God and without hope. And that's a very vivid description of the life of an abuse survivor when they have undergone this type of abuse. Let me wrap up the bad section. I want to get to the good section. Do you feel something here? You get a sense of what the abuse survivor's world is like, the world that if you're going to reach out with the redemptive word of God to them, you're going to have to know, you're going to have to get close to, you're going to have to be impacted by. Diane Langberg says in her book, this is a great line, sexual abuse is hell brought up to earth's surface. Sexual abuse is hell brought up to earth's surface. Let's start working our way out of that hellish state. Let's talk about how, if you are going to be somebody who is going to work one-on-one, life-on-life, individually, with a person who has been the victim of sexual abuse, how do you help this person? Well, the first place, it's on your outline, is listen. Did you notice that the way I'm structuring this talk here this morning? I've said this repeatedly. You're going to have to hear the bad stuff first, because you're going to need to have to feel and think what the world of a survivor is like. And this is the type of listening that we have to do, where we are so fully engaged with that person that we push our own thoughts aside and we focus intently on their words and the meaning of those words so that we might listen. And it's especially hard to do this when the person in front of you is not only telling you so many pain-filled stories, but you can begin to feel the pressure that they put on you. I want this over with. What's our natural tendency when it comes to listening? It's to run words and phrases in our own mind so that we can quickly speak back to them. We like to give advice. We like to explain the unexplainable. And we feel pressure to make them to feel better, so we speak quickly into their life. We'll throw out a Bible verse or two to try to explain what really we can't explain. And we do this because we are uncomfortable. And we do this because we are also struggling to make sense of that suffering. One of the worst things that can happen when you speak before listening is that you can begin to speak in such a way, try to explain something that really is unexplainable, and you can do so in a way in which the abuse survivor begins to feel it's their fault for while they went through that. This is very important. Never say or imply that a survivor is to blame for the abuse. Nothing that a child can do or a teenager does ever justifies sexual abuse. A rape victim, for instance, when she is assaulted, no matter what her dress is, no matter what her behavior was, she is not responsible for that rape. The rapist is. Okay? It's very, very important. Another way we listen is sometimes and oftentimes here being silent and using just minimal words like, look, sometimes the most helpful thing you can do is to say, I am sorry that you went through this. I am sorry that this is the pain that you are experiencing in your life. You're there to listen first and to wait upon God to bring His words to him or her through you. If any of you have ever gone through some deep suffering in your life, you will know that sometimes the most powerful ways people have helped you is not by explaining things to you or throwing Bible verses at you. It's just coming up to you and acknowledging how deeply you hurt and feeling how deeply you hurt. That's a form of listening to the person. I mentioned that Diane Langberg says in her book that abuse survivor has lost his or her voice. Recall that when you lose your voice, you feel powerless and helpless, alone. What the survivor needs then is to be heard. She or he needs to be believed. They need to learn how to use a voice that has been shut down their entire life or shut down by the trauma. They need to speak truth that's been silenced. They need to finally weep and know what comfort feels like. To finally voice the anger and the rage that they have long felt and not be condemned and criticized. Learn how to use their voice for the first time. Having a voice is like what Adam did with the animals. Naming the hurts, naming the trauma, naming the suffering is a way that brings light and clarity and understanding to the confusion and the darkness that they grew up in. And healing comes when the abuse survivor distinguishes their own confused voice from the abuser's voice, and the abuser's voice from God's voice. And the way you will help them to do that is to listen and learn about their world. You know, I said before, it's not easy to do this type of listening, but there's two reasons why you absolutely have to. One is, you got to learn who that person is sitting in front of you. Their suffering is unique. to them. We talked about common themes, but you must know who they are and how suffering has specifically shaped them. That's why you need to listen. But the second reason is, as well, I've hinted at, you need to be impacted by what you hear. When you feel the weight of the damage that's been done, that's when you're going to fall on your knees and ask God to help you and the person that you desire to help. Because you're going to recognize that you are not enough for this person. You're going to recognize that the battle you are in is not just a battle of flesh and blood. It is a supernatural battle. Because the evil that produces such abuse and such damage is supernatural. You need to pray. You need to pray often. You're being shaped and formed through this as well. And unless prayer forms the very basis for what you're doing, you will be powerless to help others. And when you listen like this, you're going to become aware that God is doing His work, not only in the person you're attempting to help. He is also shaping and working in you as well. The type of listening I'm talking about is incarnational. Isn't that what Jesus did for us? Hebrews says, since the children have flesh and blood, He too shared in their humanity. There is real power when we communicate to someone, principally at times through the way we listen to them, that Christ fully knows and understands their suffering because He suffered just like they did and even more. That's at the very heart of the gospel, that Christ entered into the sin and suffering of our world and was broken for us, so that in His brokenness we may be brought to wholeness. And that's how you bring the gospel into that person's life. Number two, patience. There's no formula here. There's no 12 steps. There's no quick turnaround. You need to wait for God to do His healing work in their life and in your life. And it's going to take time. It's going to take time. When you work with an abuse survivor, you need to prepare for the long haul. And when you truly listen and you develop the patience of God in you, then the person in front of you is not just going to become a ministry project that's going to wear you out because their suffering never seems to end. That person's going to be in need. You're going to see that person as the type of person where God's redemptive work is done in the way He usually does it. And the way that God usually does His redemptive work is through people and over time. Right? Hasn't He done that with you? And He doesn't do that just once in our lives, does He? He works through in us through people over our life. Secondly, that patience and waiting upon God is not passive. It means pursuing them. It means going after them in love. When I was going through a lot of my own struggles with one son who's disabled and another son who died, one of the things that people would do would say, you know, if you need anything, give us a call. Let me tell you, I never made that call. And the reason why is because I was so overwhelmed by the sorrow and the suffering and the stress, and I felt ashamed that I was so weak and so needy. Abuse survivors will feel like that. You call them. You email them. You write them. You go knock on their door because they don't have what it takes at this point to reach out for help. One more thing about patience. You'll need to wait and stay with them as they honestly begin to confront the abuse and the damage that was done to them. You know, they'll look good on the outside until they begin to really to wrestle with this. And it's common for abuse survivors to take a very long time before they really begin to touch upon the deepest hurts, the deepest abuse, the deepest damage. Some people know that sometimes they will dance around what really happens for the longest time until they actually finally get to that point. In my own life, I had to go for counseling following the death of my son. A year later, I was a mess emotionally, spiritually, physically. And I carried with me a group of poems, a collection of poems that a friend gave me who wrote about my son's death because she wanted these poems to be used in my healing. And I never looked at them. I wouldn't open them. And I sat in the counselor's office with the file of the, poems next to me for weeks, and I wouldn't look at it. I was so scared to open that up because I was afraid that when I did, there would be such an explosion of pain and grief, I felt like I would not, it would not be able to be contained. That's what happens when you keep surviving. Wait. Wait for them to reach the point when they're able to talk. Number three, learn. Learn. First and foremost, obviously, learn of God. Learn of Him through the Scriptures. If you're going to be used by God, then you must desire to let Him first shape you. This isn't book knowledge. You're not building up a collection of verses to throw at them or to use them. You're studying the Scriptures so that you might see Christ. And as God does His shaping work in you, then you're going to learn to love the way He loves, in mercy, in grace, over time, with truth. And the second thing you need to learn is be a student of this topic. Partly you're doing that here by attending this seminar. But learn everything you can about sexual abuse. Study it. Learn what it's like to live with helplessness and powerlessness and all the things I've talked about. Again, there are common themes. You need to build up this repertoire of knowledge, but you will still be talking to the specific person that you are helping. Number four, speak. What do you say to a survivor? What do you speak? You speak the truth about God in the context of their suffering. You speak the truth about God in the context of their suffering. Again, it doesn't mean pitching Bible verses at them or being theological with them or challenging them to believe when they're totally crippled by doubt. It means speaking the truth about who Jesus is and patiently showing them who He is to them. It means talking about Jesus enough so that they begin to see that Jesus, if you look at Scripture, is always drawn to the people who are most messed up. And He's always drawn to the people who are most messed up in life. That's what the Savior is like. It means introducing them to a Savior who does know what suffering is, who voluntarily suffered for us. It means showing that God understands their suffering as they read the Word. Let Jesus be your focus. What else do you speak? Here's one thing you don't speak. When you speak to them of God, you honestly admit that you don't have all the answers. That you don't try to answer what is unanswerable. There's no answer for why they were horribly mistreated. There's no answer for why God did not intervene to prevent or stop the abuse. There's none. But there is Jesus, who is God's answer to sin, suffering, and death. See the distinction? There is Jesus who knows rejection, who knows physical pain, who endured assaults on His body, who knows what it's like to be humiliated, who understands what loneliness is, and was abandoned at the most critical point of His life. This is the Savior you want them to know. Jesus must be enough for you and for them. And five, involve. And by involve, I mean several things, very quickly. One, as they have allowed you into your life, allow them into your life as they have allowed you into their life. What I mean by this is please, please don't let the only time you ever see them or talk to them be about this. They're going to feel like a ministry project. They're going to feel like a failed ministry project. relate to them as whole persons. Invite them into your family. Have them over for dinner. Go to the movies. Go to the beach. Take them on vacation. There's a great sense of belonging that abuse survivors need, because particularly if they grew up in a dysfunctional, terroristic home, they need to know what it's like to be in a home where there's safety, where there's love. And then secondly, invite others to help you when it's appropriate and when they're able to have other people join you. This is a deep spiritual battle, and you don't want to only walk this road alone. And third, if the individual needs to see a professional, help them find that person. Contribute financially to them if they don't have the money. Help the church to help them financially. And if they see a counselor, you're not off the hook, okay? They still need you. They need you in their lives. I remember what John Freeman said last night. He said, one of the reasons why we're silent in the church, and why the church is silent about all these difficult issues, because we don't see people change sometimes. And we think that the gospel, though we won't say it, we think that the gospel is just ineffective. It doesn't work. But it does work. We need to believe that it works, because it worked in our life. And when we show people Jesus, who he really is, he can break through those walls. He can break through the damage that is done. And through people, over time, people grow, and people change, and people heal. I'm gonna end at this point. I think the things about what the church does corporately are embodied in the things that I spoke about individually. But I want to leave with this verse. The finished work of Christ in all our lives looks like this from Psalm 30. You have turned for me my mourning into dancing. You have loosed my sackcloth and clothed me with gladness, that my glory may sing your praise and not be silent. O Lord, my God, I will give thanks to you forever. And my prayer for all of us here is that we may be God's people who are shaped by his hand to become his people, who will do his work as he leads the broken and the weary, the sin-damaged lives to know what dancing ultimately feels like. And it does happen in this life. Let's pray. Lord, this is a dark topic. Thank you that you are the God of light and the God of truth. Thank you that you are a God who stepped into the darkness of this world, into the darkness of our lives, in order to rescue us. Help us to believe more and more, Lord, that you are on the throne and you continue to do this work, that you are reclaiming so many. And so I ask that those who are here, including myself, will hunger for you and seek after you, and be willing to be shaped and molded by you